Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi there, this is Martina Navratilova, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello, welcome to the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph, on a day after Agnieszka Radwańska brought out the Jedi from within and used the force to quell Petra Kvitova and the rest to win the WTA finals in Singapore. And talking of Jedis, Obi-Wan himself, Roger Federer, was back to his intergalactic best. It's good, this, isn't it? To overcome his own personal Darth Vader, Rafael Nadal, 6-3 in the third set in Basel. We'll be talking about all of that. We'll discuss whether round robin works. We'll talk about whether the season is too long. I've been canvassing the opinion of all sorts of people about those two issues. And we'll hear about the new generation of American players coming through the ranks, including Taylor Fritz, who met the great Pete Sampras in an ATP Champions Tour event in Mexico last week. Sampras gave him a birthday cake. Pretty cool, isn't it? First of all, though, let's say hello to Singapore's Catherine Whittaker, because that's where you've been, isn't it, Catherine?
I have, but I no longer belong to Singapore, thank goodness. I'm back in slightly more temperate climes.
Yes, you are. And the first thing that happened to you was that you couldn't watch Roger Federer against Rafael Nadal. What happened?
Sky Broadband happened, a monumental failure on the part of Sky Broadband. It was out across South London. I'm sure there are people listening feeling my pain from yesterday. Throughout Sunday, no broadband, and I've used up my entire 4G allowance for the month to stream. I had to use the length I went to. I had to tether my laptop to my phone and stream the tennis on there using my 4G. I mean, worth every penny, but pennies that I hope Sky will be reimbursing me for, because it was
absolutely Catherine Whittaker. Don't mess with Catherine's Sky Broadband. That's my advice. She's not happy. Now, Catherine, just before we get on to talking about the WTA finals in Singapore, where Agnieszka Radwańska was the champion, just a quick note here from Victoria Smythe. We were talking about places and times that our listeners listen to the Tennis Podcast. This is my absolute personal favourite, and it was given to me on Halloween night. Victoria says, I listen to the Tennis Podcast while trick-or-treating tonight.
That's a bit weird. Don't you have to, you know, don't you need to be able to be listening to what's going on? I need to know more about those circumstances. I feel like...
Is the podcast the trick or the treat? That's what I want to know. Do they say it right? Your trick is you have to listen to the entire back catalogue.
while we're back on the subject of there was a glaring omission when we last discussed most weird and wonderful places that people listen to the podcast, because my dear dad isn't on Twitter, but if he were, I feel I should on his behalf submit the fact that he listened to every podcast for 6 months whilst bobbing around on the Pacific Ocean. That has to be up there in amongst the top ranks of tennis podcast listening locations.
That is pretty good. I mean, the one slight concern about that is, imagine all the listening material out there in the world, and he chose to listen to this rubbish. I mean, what is he thinking? Anyway, Agnieszka Radwańska was the champion in Singapore. $2 million she scooped. She was tearful at the end. And I think there were a few other people tearful watching her win that tournament, Catherine, because she was really a joy to behold, wasn't she? The way she played the game, dealing with the power of Muguruza and then Kvitova in the final, it was a pleasure to watch.
It was a pleasure to watch. I know we've debated at length in the past few podcasts about, you know, aesthetic appreciation and what you enjoy on the tennis court being completely subjective. And of course, to an extent it is. There will be people out there that don't enjoy watching Agnieszka Radwańska for whatever reason, and that can't be helped. But I do think you know, there's a reason why she's been winning those fan favourite awards. And to generalise for a moment, she is a joy to watch. She is, because she's something different. She wins rallies in the most sensational fashion, you know, pulling out these extraordinary drop volleys, anticipating where the ball's going to be in a way that no other players can. And she does it time after time. Every time I watch her, I think, well, that was an extraordinary rally and an extraordinary shot to win the point. But surely she can't pull that out enough times to win a match. And then, lo and behold, she does it. And she did it enough times to actually win what is now the biggest tournament victory of her career. And I thoroughly enjoyed every minute that I watched of her in full flow.
Yeah, I'm using all the toe-curling Star Wars references in the opener, but they do stand, I think, because if you think of how the Jedis go about their business in Star Wars, they do everything without looking, and they can close their eyes and do it blindfolded. And you get the feeling that Radvanska could play tennis like that. She does all these sort of... her anticipation is just... there's a sixth sense about it.
That's exactly what I was going to say. And it's interesting you mentioned tennis blindfolded, because one of the things they did out in Singapore was a demonstration on the centre court of sound ball, which is tennis for the blind. And it was with Arantxa Sánchez Vicario, and she was blindfolded, and the tennis ball has a tiny little bell in it, which makes a very low-level noise. And I mean, it's an incredible sport. I'd recommend you get out there. It's not the only sport where the version for the blind or visually impaired is, I think, football for the blind and visually impaired also involves the ball having a little bell in it. It's so fascinating. And Arantxa Sánchez Vicario was amazing at it, absolutely amazing. They just put this blindfold on her, and she knew, I mean, with the minute help of this little tinkle, she knew where that ball was going to be. And I'd imagine Agnieszka Radwanska would be every bit as good, if not better, because she understands the flight of a tennis ball and understands her opponents better, I think, than anybody else on tour. It's Murray-esque, really. It's Murray-esque.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Petra Kvitova came through the round-robin stages having only won one match out of the three. I think she'll be pretty happy with how things went, the fact that she got to the final, and particularly given the physical ailments that she's been suffering from over the last 12 months or so. Maria Sharapova was a semi-finalist. She went 3-0 in the round-robin stages. I think she would have signed up to that in a heartbeat before the event, because we didn't even know if the woman would be able to play.
I think before the event she would have done. However, now, having played as well as she did in those first three matches and for patches of that semi-final match as well, I think she now will be thoroughly disappointed. Because after those first three matches, she was the... with the addition of Garbiñe Muguruza, she was the nailed-on favourite, at least for the final, which, yes, she wasn't going in. There were many question marks. But by that stage, I think she would have been disappointed with anything other than, at the very least, the final. I think in the bigger picture, this is obviously a huge step forward for her. She hadn't played since Wimbledon. So to get three match wins, very impressive match wins over the three of the best players in the world, of course, that's sensational. But I think still, on the day she lost to Petra Kvitova, that will have been a bitter pill to swallow, I think, because we know how high the standards Maria Sharapova sets for herself are. And, you know, I described in the last podcast her game face in that backstage room before the draw. You know, she wanted this badly, and after those first three matches, she will have thought, there's no reason I can't win it. So for her...
Martina Navratilova said that Agnieszka Radwanska's performance in that final was the best of her entire career. Pretty generous words, particularly given the fact that it didn't work out too well for them early on in the year as a coaching and player relationship. But I still wonder whether maybe remnants of that relationship are responsible for what we're seeing now. Some of the advice, the guidance that Navratilova gave. But those are very, very big words, and I just wonder whether from here Radwanska is a genuine Grand Slam title contender for next year.
Yeah, but I think she has been all... I mean, maybe not in the early parts of this year, where there definitely was something missing, and that relationship with Martina Navratilova, for whatever reason, I think a lot of people thought that would be a match made in heaven, but it was obviously like square peg in round hole in practice. And I'd love to, hopefully one day, one or both of them will talk about why that relationship didn't work out, because I'd love to know. But I think she has been a Grand Slam contender for a number of years now. I mean, look at the WTA Tour. Flavia Panetta won the last Grand Slam. I mean, of course, Agnieszka Radwanska is capable of winning a Grand Slam. She just needs to string it together at the right time. And unfortunately, and she's not alone in this, probably not meet Serena Williams along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that is one of the big question marks, isn't it? Because Serena Williams has always dominated her, as has Sharapova. That's what made, I think, Radwanska's dealing with Kvitova and Muguruza of the power that they possess so impressive. But anyway, Radwanska's the champion. They celebrated that in Warsaw outside the Olympic Stadium by putting the words Bravo Aga around the Olympic Stadium, which was a lovely touch and shows just how much of an impact that her victory had over there. And she can now go into the off-season, another subject we'll be discussing a little bit later in the podcast, with a big smile on her face. Now, Rafael Nadal against Roger Federer, installment 34. Happened on Sunday, and it went to Roger Federer in a third set. But it was a pretty thrilling encounter. Nadal came back and won the second set 7-5. It was in Federer's hometown of Basel, a tournament where he's reached the final the last 10 years in a row. But first and foremost, Catherine, just nice to see those two players sharing the court again. It's been nearly 2 years, the Australian Open in 2014 being the last.
Yeah, I had goosebumps almost throughout. I had that weird bittersweet feeling that you sort of get when watching the Wimbledon final, you know, of, oh, this is the pinnacle, but it's also the sign that it's all going to be over really soon. And I now have that with Federer and Nadal. I hope not too soon, but you don't know when the last one will be. You don't know. It's taken 2 years for them to meet, so you'd be surprised, probably. I mean, you can argue with me, but you'd be, if it takes another 2 years for them to meet again, you'd be surprised if
probably be on the Champions Tour.
Well, exactly. So I did have that feeling of, oh my gosh, I've got to savour every single minute of this. Damn you, Sky Broadband. I had so many emotions going on all at the same time. And I revelled in every moment of it from a sort of nostalgic point of view, just from a tennis appreciation point of view, because it is the most glorious clash of styles, isn't it? It's the perfect rivalry, and it reminded me of that, and it reminded me of it, sort of renewed, we're not going to go back into the whole thing of it again, but it renewed for me, I think, the point that I was trying to make during our Novak Djokovic discussion of how enhancing a rivalry is to somebody's dominance. You know, most incredibly dominant players over the years have had that one rivalry that always tests them. And, you know, for Federer, it was Nadal. It's a defining feature of dominance to have a significant rivalry. And I just think if somebody could come along and be Djokovic's Nadal, what Nadal is to Federer, if somebody could be that to Novak Djokovic, I think it would just enhance tennis. It would enhance Djokovic's dominance in a way, because I do think everything that Nadal has done and their rivalry enhanced Federer's greatness at the times of their greatest matches. And I revelled in every moment of yesterday.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Abby says that tennis fans everywhere were rejoicing. These guys were playing at such a high level once again. On Twitter, Zubair says it was a great match and I cried a little bit at the end seeing two legends past their primes but still playing great tennis. Biggish Mao said both still very capable in their own right, but can they challenge and really take down Djokovic? That, for me, is the key. That is the big question. Mr. I.A. Grant, very formal, Mr. I.A. Grant, says Nadal is slowly closing the gap again. Will we see a renewed Big Four rivalry in 2016 with Wawrinka making it five, perhaps? Oliver Eastbrook says, great to witness two legends competing for a title again. Both a long way from Djokovic, though. Tom says plenty of damage they can deal to the hegemony at the top of the game, but I'd argue that the best strategy would be to drop outside the top eight and meet Novak early on. Imagine if you did that. Imagine if you played rubbish all year, that you could play Novak early on.
Is he referring to Federer there or Nadal? Because that sort of happened at the French Open and didn't quite work out brilliantly for Nadal, did it?
I think I'm going to try that, Catherine. I'm going to play rubbish early on.
You're
so that
try,
I can meet you early on in a tournament.
You're going to try dropping out of the world's top eight. I back you to do that somehow, David.
Thanks. Clutch on and win. What a great Twitter handle that is. Says, in short, on hard court, neither of them have got any chance against Djokovic. He changes direction too well. And finally, Scott Brown says, if they play him against him together, they might have a chance. That's a bit harsh.
I mean, yes, they would have a chance. So if you're asking for my opinion on that input, yes, they would probably be the favourites.
Yeah, they probably would be. Now, we were talking about round-robin play earlier on and what we think of it. Obviously, the ATP World Tour Finals are coming up fairly soon. Andy Murray, overnight, by the way, Catherine, has confirmed at the Paris Masters that he fully intends to play the O2, which is certainly the feeling, I think, that we were getting towards over the last few weeks. Obviously, he'd questioned that significantly at the Davis Cup tie in that interview that he did with the BBC. But it does appear that he intends to play. He's also revealed that he's been practicing and preparing for the Davis Cup final on clay before the O2. So that is a very unusual method, isn't it? I mean, a couple of people reminded me that Stan Wawrinka was doing something similar a year ago. Obviously, Federer and Wawrinka both played the O2 and went on to win the Davis Cup final on clay. So it's not as though it's never been done before, but still, given that Murray is a player that hasn't always enjoyed that change of surfaces, it's a big decision to make, isn't it?
It is, but I think it's the only decision. I mean, we've discussed at length how big a physical adjustment it is for him to change surfaces to and from clay, more so than for any other top-level player, I think. So I think it's more important for him to get his body to adjust to the movement on clay. And yes, I do think he's being completely honest when he says he is now intending to play at the O2. However, I do think if he gets onto the clay before the O2 and his back presents problems, which I think in the back of his mind he knows is a possibility, I wouldn't be surprised, and it would be entirely legitimate for him to then pull out of the O2. I do think that's not out of the question. Yes, at the moment, as things stand, injury niggles aside, he will play. But we know the difficulty that transferring onto the clay can present. And I think in the back of his mind, he is not ruling out the possibility that he gets on the clay and he experiences issues, probably with the back. That's where it usually expresses itself, that transition period. So we have to say we'd expect to see him there, but I certainly, if I was in that race for ninth place in the ATP World Tour rankings, I wouldn't be giving up hope.
No, I'd not be sort of eating junk food just yet, which is what all tennis players, if they've got any sense, do in the off-season, isn't it?
I'm reliably informed. Why wouldn't you? Why? I mean, just one big cake.
I've been eating junk food in the off-season and we haven't even started it yet. Round Robin is what they'll be playing at the ATP World Tour Finals at the O2, of course, in a couple of weeks' time. When is it? It's 2 weeks' time, isn't it? The WTA Finals, of course, was also played round robin. 8 best players in the world. A lot of chat, though, as to whether that is the best format. Is it not a problem that you had Angelique Kerber needing, I think it was just a set, to go through to the semi-finals, which would have put Petra Kvitova out? And she did appear to be, at least, inhibited by that fact. It seemed as though the permutations were going around in her mind as she was playing her match. Is that ideal? Should a player that has only won one match and lost two be getting through to the semi-finals, Catherine Whittaker?
Yeah, I mean, I think round robin is a fantastic thing. I wouldn't want to see it year round, but I think it works perfectly with this format of having the 8 best players in the world, because being the best at any moment isn't necessarily about being able to beat absolutely everybody. We've seen that. You know, Roger Federer was the best for many years, but had a losing record against Rafael Nadal. I don't think anybody would question that he was still the best during that period.
And was he though?
Oh, having just said I don't think anybody would question it, up pipes David Law, of course. I think Angelique Kerber let herself down with the comments she made. I have to say, I mean, that was something, it's the same for everybody. And I know her comments were that those final two matches should be played simultaneously because otherwise it's not fair for everybody. But there, she knows all of the practical and commercial reasons why that absolutely cannot be the case. She knows all those and she understands all those. And I think it was a touch of poor loserdom and knowing, I think she knew she'd let herself down a bit in that match, and that it was a bit of a mental failure from her to let that get to her in the way she did. And I think she lashed out. You know, Angelique Kerber is an absolutely delightful lady. She really is lovely, but she's one of the ones that has the biggest disparity in how she is generally and how she is when she loses. She's not a great loser, and I think that was what expressed itself in those comments. And I think it's really interesting to see that extra dimension thrown in, to see them have to deal with something different that they don't have to at any other stage in the year, and exposed a weakness in Angelique Kerber which we don't see at any other time in the year. And I found that really interesting.
Was I a good loser?
You were an appalling loser, David. Are you giving me another opportunity to mention the fact that you actually made me win that match twice because you demanded a replay on a very clearly in ball? Or was it my ball that was in or your ball that was out? Either way, I won that match fair and square twice.
Well, are you a good loser? I wouldn't know.
You wouldn't. I mean, no one knows, David. It's the unknown.
100% record against everybody in the whole world. Michael Jabour says, round robin is the way to go. It's so exciting and players should come out swinging, stay in their bubble away from the scenario chatter. Ali says, race drivers do it, knowing that they have to finish in a certain place to win the championships. They seem to cope okay. And ATP WTA Love says, round robin. We play knockout all year. Everyone has more chances this way, and it's way more interesting. Top 16, knockout would make it all a bit boring. Well, there, it appears that most people who have had chance to comment have agreed that round robin should stay, and I suspect it will do. Now, the other question mark that I put to everybody on social media, on Twitter, at Tennis Podcast, do get in touch with us, was about the off-season generally and what people thought of it in terms of how long it should last, because obviously the WTA circuit ends a good bit earlier than the ATP circuit does, with its Davis Cup final taking place right at the end of November. And then, of course, we have the IPTL straight after, pretty much. And I was wondering, A, is everybody okay with that? Is it fine that we have that little time without tennis? And B, from a tennis...
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. Player's perspective. What is the ideal situation? So what I did, Catherine, is I contacted a few people, a few players and coaches and commentators and ex-players on Twitter and canvassed a little bit of opinion.
To and, get more those credible opinions than ours, basically.
Oh, well, absolutely. Yeah, people actually know how to play the game, know one end of the racket from the other. Yevgeny Kafelnikov has suddenly become really animated on Twitter with the Tennis Podcast. He really likes talking to us. And if you'd like to follow him, he's at @kyevgeny. I know you know Yevgeny quite well, Catherine, from your time on the ATP Champions Tour. He says, I needed only 1 week of no tennis in the off-season. 1 week off. That's all I needed.
Yeah, Yevgeny was a unique player, in a unique individual in every way, though, wasn't he? I mean, he did play a more punishing schedule than everybody else. I fully believe that that's the case, but I think he's the exception rather than the rule. I mean, he ground out the matches, didn't he? He did used to play week in, week out, and more often than not, he won. So that's definitely it's interesting to know, but I don't think we should be perhaps legislating on the basis of Yevgeny Kafelnikov's physical makeup, because I do think he's the exception rather than the rule.
Well, one interesting thing is that both Robbie Koenig, the former doubles player and now a commentator, he and Yevgeny were both saying on Twitter about they felt that rather than having a long off season, the best thing for a player is to have a few little breaks throughout the year to build in 1 or 2 weeks around your schedule. And in Yevgeny's case, he said a week after the Australian Open, one after Wimbledon, one after the US, that's where you should have your breaks rather than having one great big lump sum at the end of the year.
Yeah, I find that very interesting, actually. Maybe we should be talking in terms of, you know, extending the rest period generally rather than shortening the season, extending the rest period as a whole, I mean. And that's sort of what Roger Federer is doing now, isn't it? You do see him take 2 or 3 weeks off at a couple of points throughout the season. Of course, he's in the exceptional category of player for whom Masters Series events aren't mandatory. But then they are mandatory in the sense that he wants to keep his ranking up. He certainly wants to remain in that top two of the world, so he's not meeting Novak Djokovic till the finals. So yes, they're not mandatory, but there is still a great incentive for him to play them. But that is sort of what Federer has done. And look at the results. I mean, Federer is the icon of longevity in the sport, isn't he? So he in himself, and also I would give a lot of credence to the words of Robbie Koenig and Ivan Ljubicic. I'd say that's a very strong argument.
Yeah, Ivan Ljubicic was very clear as well. He said, I like smaller breaks instead of long ones. And particularly younger players, though, he said, certainly for older players, better to have a number of smaller breaks. He said younger players, though, can benefit from the longer off season to make some changes to their game. That was an interesting viewpoint. Jamie Delgado, who's the coach of Gilles Muller, says that I asked him what Muller is doing with his off season. He said he's having a week in Dubai with the family to put his feet up. Then he'll start properly in mid-November. Raymond Slauter, who was world number 46 a few years ago, Dutch player, very nice guy and a very excellent, really excellent Davis Cup player back in the day as well. He said that he used to have 2 weeks off, 4 weeks for preparation was his normal schedule. And in that 4 week spell of preparation for the new season, he would have two times a day of tennis, one occasion where he would do some physical work per day, and he would do that 6 days a week. Imagine doing that lot, 6 days a week. Crikey, I can barely get out of bed to do it once.
Crikey. Another point that's worth mentioning is that the more successful you are, the more matches you play. That's sort of an interesting, you know, if you're losing first round every week, yes, you know, on that schedule, you could be playing tournament week after week. And of course, you're on the practice courts on days when you're not on the match court. But as we know, for various reasons, physical and mental, match court is a lot more stressful on the body and the mind than the practice court. You know, if you're losing first round every week, that's significantly fewer matches than Novak Djokovic and Roger Federer and Andy Murray right at the top, who are playing, you know, when they do enter tournaments, they're playing probably five or six times in a week. So the more your schedule plays dividends, the more you're tying yourself in knots by playing more matches. And also, the higher you get up the rankings, the more likely you are to get offered the exhibitions, to get offered the big bucks to play the IPTL, and therein lies an extra dilemma.
Yes, indeed. Well, there certainly are plenty of occasions that you are offered very enticing rewards for playing more. There's no question about that. I do feel, though, some players just sign up for way too much throughout the year and end up costing themselves physically when they get to the back end of the season. One other comment that was interesting actually came from Judy Murray on Twitter, completely unrelated to this issue. She wasn't replying to our request for contributions. She just put out on Twitter, unsolicited, seriously, ATP and WTA, the tennis season is way too long. Sometimes less is more. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I know that Steve Simon, the new CEO of the WTA, agrees with her. He did a press conference in Singapore, his first press conference in the job, his first big press conference in the job. And he was asked, you know, first question, hard-hitting one, he was asked what his priorities are. And he said, unquestionably, it's shortening the season. Now, whether he has in mind to create gaps or, you know, whatever it is, or whether he just wants to physically shorten it so the off-season is longer, you know, he was very clear that I've no idea how I'm going to do this. We know how big a mountain that is to climb, but he was very clear that it is one major priority, and it was music.
This is the problem, though. So many people have tried this. That's the problem, is how do you actually do it? When you look at all the component parts of the tennis calendar, the amount of people that have got a vested interest, players, tournaments, sponsors, it's a real soup of different types of interests, isn't it? And very, very difficult to get anybody to do anything differently from what they're already doing. You've got to have such an idealistic viewpoint and just be prepared to just charge it through, or you've got to be the most fabulous politician. And I think one example of how things can change is what Phil Brook did with Wimbledon.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I mean, I think for all those reasons you've just said, that was why I found it particularly impressive that Steve Simon didn't beat around the bush or mince his words with that being his priority, because, you know, he set himself a marker and a target. Now, if he fails to achieve that, it will probably be judged a failure. So to set himself a target that we know is probably the most difficult to achieve thing in our sport, in terms of, you know, the being an executive in our sport, I found it impressive that he didn't shy away from making that one of the major markers by which his reign as CEO will be measured.
One thing I do agree with Judy about is that I do think an off-season is important for tennis fans, as well as for players and for the overall quality of the product. I think it's important to miss tennis to some degree, and I think that is one of the problems we have with the IPTL. I think as a general concept, as an idea, and from what we actually saw produced last year, I thought the tennis was really entertaining. I thought the camaraderie shown between the players was refreshing, having them all out on the court. I think there was so much good about the IPTL last year. I just think its position in the calendar makes it undesirable ultimately, because you just don't get chance enough time to have away from tennis, the way that you do with a football season. I think when you don't have the World Cup in the British football season, the European football season, for instance, and you get that couple of months off, you get time to miss it. And I think that's quite healthy.
Yeah, I mean, my recommendation, if you do want to have the opportunity to miss tennis, is to sign up to Sky Broadband.
Absolutely. Catherine Whittaker is not going to let this lie, Sky Broadband. You better get around there. Now, Catherine, before we sign off for another episode, the ATP Champions Tour has been in Monterrey, Mexico for the first time over the last week. John McEnroe, Pete Sampras, Mats Wilander, Thomas Muster, Henri Leconte and Thomas Enquist were all there. Sampras won it, beating the ageless John McEnroe in the final. The week was also notable for the fact that the tournament is also played alongside a challenger tournament, and one very nice greatest moments saw Sampras, one of the greatest players of all time, certainly in the US, presenting a birthday cake to the newly turned 18-year-old Taylor Fritz, of whom a lot is expected in America. He's one of a crop of bright young things from the United States. And I spoke to Josh Mizell, who was the man in charge of organizing the media operation out in the ATP Champions Tour event there in Monterey. He also works very closely on the Challenger Tour throughout the year. And I asked him, first of all, about the final between Sampras and McEnroe and whether Sampras could still play.
He can, and I tell you, Johnny Mac can play as well. I mean, that final, especially the second set, was extremely tight. And for someone as old, as Sampras said after the match, for someone as old as McEnroe is, he can move very well.
And there was this lovely moment where Sampras, I saw the pictures that you put out on social media of Sampras with this young fella, Taylor Fritz. He got a birthday cake for him, a massive, great big chocolate cake, which isn't exactly setting a great example, is it? Where they're supposed to be professional athletes. But anyway, we'll overlook that. And he had a bit of a hit with him as well, didn't he? What did he make of Taylor Fritz?
Well, first of all, that was a completely unexpected moment because Sampras actually suggested to hit with Taylor Fritz, and Taylor is a huge, always been a huge Sampras fan growing up, and when I spoke to Taylor at the U.S. Open, he mentioned that, and I sort of slotted it in the back of my mind, and then when Sampras mentioned that on the first day, and he didn't have a hitting partner for his first practice, I thought, well, this is a perfect, so I approached Taylor, and we coordinated it, and Taylor was completely in the dark about it. His coach actually told him that they found someone else for him to hit with and that Pete wasn't available. And then he strolled up onto the practice court and Pete was waiting there with a cake in his hands. And it was just, the expression on his face was pretty much like a kid in a candy store.
That's fantastic.
It was unbelievable. And they hit for a half hour and Pete was on the ground afterwards. He was so tired, because Taylor just had him moving left to right, and it was quite the moment. And then for about 20 minutes after the practice, they chatted on the side, and Pete gave him some good pointers and some tips on how to improve his game. And it was just a very, very nice moment to combine those two tours in that way. And that's,
yeah, I saw one of the tips that he gave young Taylor Fritz was, get off your phone.
Yes. Or right after the practice, Taylor went to the chair, and he just sat down and pulled out his phone. And Pete sat standing there looking at him like, what? And Taylor's coach, Christian Groh, who actually works with Tommy Haas, he started laughing, and he said, he's 18 now, so it happens.
Sure happens. Now, I mean, you're around the Challenger circuit quite a lot. There is a group of them, isn't there? Taylor Fritz is, there's a lot of talk about him. Tell us why that is. I mean, he's a big guy. He's mm-hmm. Pete Sampras was saying he's got a big game, and he's won a lot of matches recently, hasn't he? But he's not the only one. He's one of a group of young Americans of whom a lot is expected.
It is pretty remarkable to see. I mean, he played Tommy Paul in the final of the U.S. Open as another rising American, and you have players like the great story with Francis Tiafoe and Stefan Kozlov, Michael Moe. You just have an immense group of just talent for these rising Americans, and they're all under the age of 19, which is pretty remarkable. And Taylor in particular has a big game, but he can also has the mindset of keeping points short and not taxing his body so much at such a young age. And that's important. I was talking to his coach about that in Monterey, and that's what he emphasized, the fact that they did not, I mean, he's been playing for, he played the U.S. Open, played three challengers in a row, then went down to Mexico. They don't want to tax him so much, but his style of play doesn't really yield that. So it was good to see, and he definitely has a bright future.
Is there one of these that, when you talk to coaches around the circuit, the Challenger circuit, is there one of them or is there two of them that are expected to sort of have their head and shoulders above the rest eventually? Because if you think back to that group of Sampras and Courier and Chang and Agassi and David Wheaton, they were all around at the same time, and they all had their moments, didn't they? Where and obviously Sampras and Agassi probably ahead of all of them, maybe Courier as well. But which is the one that is creating the most buzz out of all of those?
Well, it's funny because if you asked me that a year ago, I'd probably say Stefan Kozlov, because he made the final of, he was one of the youngest Americans to make a final of a challenger when he did so in Sacramento. And since then, Francis Tiafoe has sort of stuck his head above the rest at the beginning of the year. And then and Tommy Paul did the same in qualifying for the U.S. Open, one of 10 teenagers, I believe, to qualify for the U.S. Open, and the only American. And then now it's Taylor. And exactly, that's exactly what Taylor said to me, was that they're all pushing each other. And you can see that, because they all want to be the best. They're all having their moments, and it's really difficult to choose one that's going to have the best career. And that's what's so intriguing about this dynamic between these young Americans, is that we don't really know. One month we think we know, and then the next month another one of them has a great result and takes the spotlight.
And what about this this young Swedish lad? There are Swedish brothers, aren't they? Elias and Mikael, who have done so well, and they've actually had a really big result, haven't they, for the Davis Cup over the last 24 hours?
Yes, Sweden beat Denmark. Actually, Mikael beat Denmark in a deciding rubber in the fifth set. He actually won two live rubbers, his first two, at the age of, I believe he's 17 years old. Yet he reached the final of the Junior Wimbledon this year and actually lost to another rising American, Riley Opelka, in the final. But
Riley Opelka, isn't he as big as Ivo Karlovic?
I've heard that he's actually still growing and he might be the first seven-footer on tour. Which is incredible, but he's a man mountain, and he's got a huge serve, and definitely another American to keep an eye on. But yes, Mikael, he pushed Sweden back into Group One and avoided relegation, and he was the hero this week. And when I was in Monterey, I mentioned that to Mats Wilander about both Elias and Mikael. And asked them, since Robin Soderling has drifted away, who from Sweden is really picking up the slack and surging to the forefront? And he immediately pointed to these two young kids and said that it's just a fascinating story on top of their talent, the fact that their father is an immigrant from Africa, and that dynamic is just creating just all this attention for them. And it's just fascinating.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see how these young players evolve, how their careers develop, whether they become the players that we're all talking about in the next 5 to 10 years. Josh, been great to have your insight. Thanks very much for joining us here on the Tennis Podcast.
Anytime, David. Appreciate it.
Tell you what, Catherine, it whets the appetite, doesn't it, to hear about all these young American players, particularly the Americans. I mean, Mikael Ymer as well, and his brother Elias, that's a lovely little storyline in itself. But goodness me, we've missed a group of strong American players. Andy Roddick, yes, he did have some support from James Blake and Marty Fish, Robbie Ginepri for a while, but there has been a lack of really strong and very young American talent at the top end of the game. Now, some of the players that Josh talked about there are ranked way down in the rankings currently because they've barely started. Opelka is 905 in the world, Kozlov is 409, Taylor Fritz is the highest at 205, Tommy Paul at 316. But still, it is nice to think that we may have a group of American players at the top end again in the future.
It really is. And unfortunately, the wait there's been for that does inevitably mean that there is going to be enormous pressure on these guys' shoulders. I mean, I hear the name Taylor Fritz mentioned more than I've heard the name of any other youngster in recent history, really. I mean, to say that he's being talked about is an understatement. You know, the yearning, not just for an American champion, of course that's important, but for the yearning for there to be that group, that, you know, that Sampras, Agassi, Chang, Courier. I mean, of course, to expect that again is probably too much, but to have a group where more than one is a genuine Grand Slam contender, I mean, I think it's important that all the Grand Slam holding nations have have players that can challenge for the title. I think it enhances those tournaments, which are the most important tournaments of the year in tennis. The one that I'm most excited by in terms of watching and the story is Francis Tiafoe. I think he, if he could put it all together, would just be magnificent for tennis. You know,
why is that?
His dad was an immigrant from Sierra Leone. He got a job as a janitor in a local tennis club. He and the whole family, Francis and his I think younger brother, lived in one bedroom actually on site at the tennis club where his dad was a janitor. One of the few perks was that the family got use of the tennis courts when the members weren't using them. Francis picked up a racket, had enormous talent, but still, you know, into his early teens, didn't have the money to go on the circuit and make a go of it on the junior circuit. I mean, and he's been backed by a benevolent billionaire, I think, somebody that made their money in the city, somebody that, as I understand it, hasn't done it for investment purposes. He genuinely was just completely taken by the story of Francis Tiafoe and has backed him for benevolent reasons, and also his style of play is marvelous. He's got serious skill. I would like to see him grow a bit. He's not enormous at the moment, but he's still got time. And you know, Riley Opelka, they reckon, is going to grow several more inches, don't they? Which he could probably do with stopping growing. But yeah, I mean, I am excited by the prospect of Francis Tiafoe becoming just the possibility of him becoming a force in tennis, because he's marvellous in every way.
I want you to keep growing, Riley. I love tall people. You know, we've got to stick together. That's what I say. Catherine, very nice to talk to you as always here on the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph. Do go to Telegraph Sport to read all the reports of Simon Briggs. Do subscribe on iTunes or Android to us at Tennis Podcast on Twitter. Do leave a review, because if you say nice things on iTunes about us, we go up in the rankings. We were in the top 100 all last week. That means lots more people find out about us and we can do lots more shows and loads more people download the show. But anyway, first of all, thank you for listening to us, and we'll speak to you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.